to your website. This is the M2M Podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. Ray Kinsella heard this and then plowed up part of a cornfield to make way for baseball in the movie Field of Dreams.
If you build it, he will come to your website.
As much as I'd like to spend this MTOM podcast talking baseball, we do broach the subject of this movie and its famous ghost players with Danny Angesser. He's a web designer at Iowa Public Television. Danny was here in the early days of the market-to-market website when we used to say www all the time to get you to a location on the internet. We'll talk podcasts, drones, and what it takes to get the TV show to the web each and every week. So the most difficult market-to-market producer is whom, Danny?
I can't answer that.
So it's me. Fantastic.
You are in the room, so I can't talk about you.
I get that. And I should explain why I asked that. So your job, you've been here now how many years?
About 19.
And we had the internet when you started?
Yes.
Yeah. Did we have the IP? Did we have the market-to-market website when you started?
There was a market-to-market website. I think it was one of the first redesigns that I was put on, probably around 2000 or so.
Yeah. What is the site? I mean, do you have any files from back then or snapshots of what it looked like?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know about – I'm sure we do.
Yeah.
I was kind of poking through some old folders today and to see what I could find, and I found some of the redesigns, and I'm sure we have probably what it was before that. So, yeah.
Do you have any desire to go back to the retro look at all? Was there anything about that initial experience where you're like, oh, that was pretty good?
I don't know. I mean, every redesign has its own little things. Nothing that sticks out, though.
When did you first get excited about working with the internet? Because we're about the same age, and let's face it, There really wasn't much when we went to college.
Yeah, I mean, I actually was poking around with, I guess there were BBSs even before college.
Gosh, yeah.
And I had my first connection to the internet, I guess, it was, they called it a Sharp Wizard. And it was a little, it's kind of like a PDA. And it looked like a little laptop.
Yeah.
And it had a touch screen. It was just green, you know, duotone or whatever, black and white, with a keyboard. And I even had a 2400 baud modem that I could plug into this thing. And it would allow me to do text-based dial-up to BBSs. I think I racked up a few phone bills for my parents.
Did.
Because
yeah.
Back then you had to dial in to, I think it was like CompuServe and Prodigy and things like that you take for granted.
It wasn't a local number. It wasn't an 800 number. So it was a long distance phone call from Marshalltown, Iowa to wherever you had to go.
No idea what I was doing. I didn't, it was just seeing what it was. You know, I didn't even really know what I was doing. And then that was my first computer, I guess you could say, when I went to Iowa State. I even used that to dial into, they had Project Vincent. So you could Telnet. And with that device, and access my text-based email there, and yeah, it's amazing.
Were you a part of any message boards or discussion groups where it was all laid out the way it was back then?
Not really. Oh, and to put time frame in perspective, too, that was like 93, 94, I guess, because I graduated from high school in 94. So, and I didn't start working on web pages until, you know, 95, I think, or so.
So how did you know that that's what you wanted to do?
I didn't. I mean, I've always been interested in creative things and art, design. You know, I went to school originally for architecture and didn't go all the way through that program, but and changed to journalism.
Natural progression.
Yeah, well, I had an interest in film, too, and I didn't want to leave Iowa State. I liked Iowa State. I'd been there at least I tried to get an architecture for 2 years, and I had the design skills but not the math and science, so I realized that and changed majors. And I would have been there for 5 years anyway with an architecture program. They have a year pre-arc, and then so it didn't really delay my time there by changing majors, which was nice. So it appealed to me that you could put graphics into this and make it interactive, and kind of my launching board was I created a side trail here.
That's the whole conversation. Yeah. That's the whole point of it.
Yeah, it's I'd taken a trip to Field of Dreams and created a page. I don't even know if it was a page at the time. It was just a picture of me. And I said, if you build it, they will come to your webpage, basically. Mm-hmm. And then
blatant ripoff of copyright.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when I did, and what drew people to that page was I did credit Field of Dreams in there. And so then I started getting all these emails about how do you get there? What's it cost? What's it like? You know, what to expect there? And before I knew it, I was creating my own page about Field of Dreams. About a year later, maybe, Field of Dreams called me from Dyersville. The company was called Left and Center Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
And not a lot of people know, but the Field of Dreams was owned by two different properties. So I worked with a company called Left and Center Field of Dreams. The other site was called Field of Dreams Movie Site. And they originally asked me to create a page for their festival. They had an annual Field of Dreams festival. So I did that. I did that for several years. And then turned into their company page. And so I think I worked with them for 11 years.
Really?
Until 2007. Yep. And at that point, they also had what was called the Ghost Players.
Yeah.
And they were considered the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball. You know, it was kind of a comedy routine and game. Real fun for kids to go to. And they would tour the world, too. They'd go to, I think, Korea and just all over the world. I don't know why Korea sticks out, but for some reason it does. it's a country I can pronounce.
Yes, there you go. Better than Azerbaijan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then in 2007, I believe they were getting bought out by Field of Dreams Movie Site, and I don't know all the politics of all of what happened, but they were dissolving their company, I believe, and that was going to be the last year for all of that. And since then, it sounds like some of it's come back. I haven't, you know, the last time I've been there was I think 2007, for that final. They called it the final Ghost Sunday game.
Oh, yeah, I did see that. And I know that the group, we actually did a story on Market to Market about the site, mm-hmm. because of the land and the neighbors. And, you know, yeah. You always have these issues more in town, but this is the middle of the country,
right.
Farm fields, things like that around. And I think we talked it. And yeah. The woman who was part of that group that took it over, Denise Stillman, I don't know if you saw, she just passed away here the last couple of months.
No, I didn't. I don't know what's happening. They were going to create a larger complex for baseball. I don't know if that's still happening or not.
But that was what she was trying to do, and I don't know if it's going to stall out or not.
It was a fascinating set of properties before all that happened. Just you'd pull up to the Field of Dreams, and you'd realize there's two driveways, there's two gift shops, and two signs, and you're really not sure which one you should go down. So it was a little confusing. It was in some ways kind of nice that it was going under one property. It's kind of too bad there was the back and forth. But I was honored to be able to be a part of that for 11 years, and I suppose it's probably what got me hired here, too, is having that as under my belt as kind of a significant site that I worked on.
So you said you're in year 19 here?
Yeah.
Yeah. So 99.
I just started in December 99 as a contract employee, as a Merit Resources, and then I think till 2003, I got hired on as a state employee. So
in that time, the web people sites were starting to develop. I know I don't care what it is. I just want something. It's got to have. I just have to do what everybody else is doing. Is that fair, what the web was kind of like in those years?
It was It was so basic. I just remember every progression was exciting because I remember web browsers that didn't support images. You know, I think the first one I used was Mosaic browser, was the first one that actually supported graphics. And that was appealing to me, to be able to create graphics. At the time, you know, you're like, do anything flashy you could, an animated spinning logo or something like that was super exciting. It took forever to load.
I was just going to say, especially on a dial-up modem, yeah, a lot of people had then still.
But at least in college, you had the access to the, I think they called it T1 connection, and super fast. But it was just fun to be. That was kind of like my hobby back then, was doing that on the side. You know, I wasn't looking to pursue it necessarily as a career, but I was doing random sites here and there for people too.
And at that time, I mean, I was looking back. I was looking through some Google Analytics of the market site. The earliest I could find was 2006. I'm not going to pin you down on the exact time at that point. But advancing now, we want to know if a design works. You call it what? It's just like science, A and B testing. You see what site people work, or Field of Dreams reference, which driveway works better for people to get to where you want to go.
Yeah. I think over the years we've seen just a change in how people use the web. Whether, you know, we always originally thought they all came through the front page, you know, and so that was your gateway to the rest of the site. But we've, you know, since learned that they go to pages through searches or through social media links. You know, that can be a huge driver when it's promoted through like a Facebook post or something, and just completely bypass the front page. So that front page isn't as important anymore, I guess, but it's definitely a good way to brand your site and your show.
Well, I can tell you that our site, the front page is still the front door for many, many people, because I look at the numbers and see that's where the majority of people are coming through. And I like to think that, you know, the audience was built before I started doing social media to attract. I was just trying to get new people and get them in through the door a different way. I can see some posts are more successful than others for whatever reason, whether it's the content. I still think it's more on content than the cute clickbait headline that some organizations write.
Yeah.
But by golly, those darn things work.
Yeah, exactly.
It's still about the good writing.
10 best ways to grow your crops and find out.
Number 7 will shock you.
Yeah, it'll shock you, exactly.
We should do that more.
Yeah.
Should we?
No.
No. Why don't you think that?
It's for me, it's just annoying. I think anyone that it'll pull definitely people in, but anyone that spends any time reading articles will just, it's a turnoff, I think.
Yeah. You're somebody who has, I always look to you, Danny, on inspiration of sites that you're looking at, or somebody that's doing something cool, whether it's design or layout or things like that, where Randy next to you, he makes it happen. You do still have that artistic thought, and you know, that's not going to look good on a mobile. It's not going to look good on a tablet. Is that all still back from your original, what you wanted to do was design and architecture?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely at my core, I guess, is that while I've dabbled with programming side of things, it's not where I'm comfortable or my expertise. And so I've always been a visual person. Just, I don't always have the right answers as far as visual, you know. I definitely, and everyone's got their opinion on what looks good, but that's where I'm most comfortable is in Photoshop or just, trying to make something look, it's definitely always a challenge because everyone has their opinion about what, you know, needs to be at the top of the page or a certain part of the page, or and it's definitely been more challenging for me personally to design for more screen sizes. You know, that's definitely where things are at. But yeah, it's fun. It's definitely what I like to do.
What's your preferred way to look at content on the internet now? Phone, tablet, or desktop?
It depends. I mean, it really depends on what, and it could be TV. You know, I watch a ton of, you know, whether it's YouTube or Vimeo or, you know, not even talking about Netflix. I mean, this is content that seems like that's what's on the TV a lot is internet content. Definitely mobile. I We have a desktop computer at home, but I don't. It's been weeks probably since I've touched that. You know, it's in our office, but I think maybe part of it's just being a parent. You know, and just being. It's not close to where we are normally, just socializing. So, it's usually my phone, I guess, or the TV for internet consumption.
And you also sit in front of a desktop for 8 hours a day.
Yeah, at work, definitely the desktop for work, yeah.
And you design, and I know that we've looked at various things, and the latest version of the market-to-market website is, I remember having discussions with you and Randy about, okay, now we were looking at a desktop, and we shrunk the browser made it small. So he goes, see, now it automatically shrinks and adjusts to the size. And so now we didn't have to pull it up on our phone to see how it looked. Mm-hmm. You were able to – I just – I'm always fascinated how that all works.
Yeah, and that's – there's a lot of magic there that I'm not as experienced in, that Randy definitely has a good handle on, where getting that size down is a trick. And there's, you know, you can create as many different versions, many different sizes as there are screens and beyond that. And so it's, I think we maybe kind of gear it towards maybe three sizes, but you could expand that to 10 or whatever.
Yeah.
But then it's a maintenance thing too.
Right.
It's trying to, every time there's a change to make it work everywhere.
Or some crazy harebrained market to market producer comes and says, hey, we should do this. And you're just like, I'll soon before he leaves. Paul,
exactly.
When are you going to leave, Paul? I think one of the things, if you look at the site, if you go back to 2006 and 7, I'm going to guess that the site still looks, there's still some basic design and functionality of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's still the main show. It's still the analysis and the market plus and the stories.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really revolutionized the way we present it.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree?
We've made, you know, over the years, as video has become more popular and easier to post and glorious HD, that's become more of a prominent feature on the page, definitely. And the page definitely goes back way before that time that you mentioned. I mean, like I said, it was like 2000 when I started working on redesign for a site that I was already there. But in the early days, I think it was just the transcripts, you know, because video wasn't very practical to put on. We're working on a timeline for our 50th anniversary. And one of the things I did pull up was, you know, Market to Market was the first audio – they had the first audio podcast for the station, and that was in July of 2006. But then I realized that – and that was for the market analysis, the Market Plus. But I realized that we were actually doing that all the way back to 2002, but that was in real audio format, if people remember that. So it was just available as a streaming format, and then podcasting came along and changed how we deliver that. So I would say, as you know, as the technologies and – delivery methods have changed, those maybe changed in prominence on the page too.
Were you listening to podcasts in 2002 to 6?
Well, I think 2005 is when podcasting kind of came of age, I guess. I mean, there wasn't really a platform for it. I mean, people delivered MP3 files through a web page, but not through a subscription model. Like, and I think iTunes probably revolutionized that, and I think around 2005. But I was right at the forefront of that, because that's how, even before Apple TV was out, I was using my iPod video. I forget what it's called. Was it the 5? I forget. First one with the color screen, I think, that played video. Anyway, I had a dock, and that's how I would watch video podcasts, was I would dock that to my TV. And this was in 2005, 2006, I think, and watch. I subscribed to, I don't know, a dozen video podcasts at the time. And so I was always more about the video than the audio, which is interesting, because I've kind of flipped that now, because I do more audio than video podcasts.
Do you now?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's because my son's monopolized the TV with all of his shows. So there's a show here or there that I catch on YouTube now and then, but I don't really do video podcasts as much as I used to.
Do you think there are more video podcasts now than there used to be?
I would think so. I think streaming's also gotten a lot easier to do, and so I don't know if that's more prevalent or equally so, but yeah, it's easier to do all around. So,
all right, what are your top three podcasts that you can't miss each week?
Oh boy,
you have to name names now.
Okay, well, definitely because I'm interested in tech. There's one called TWiT, This Week in Tech, and that's been around for, again, probably since 2005 or six. I mean, like, it's a weekly show that's 1 or 2 hours long, I think. And it's usually a roundtable of tech experts, hosted by Leo Laporte, if anybody remembers him. I actually got to meet him one time about 10 years ago, 9 years ago. So that's definitely one. I listen to a ton of – I've really shifted my listening interest from tech to drone related podcasts. And so there's a handful of those that I watch or listen to every day or week. The Ask Drone You is a good one. It's a couple of guys out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And they have a company and – that focuses on really training for drone pilots now. And it's, so it's a good tip. People send in a question and then they answer it. And, it's a shorter one, maybe anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes usually. What's the third one? I don't know.
Do you get comedy, entertainment, sports?
Not really.
Pop culture, some TV show that you like.
Not really.
Yeah.
No, it's usually drone specific stuff. I don't know why. I'm trying to think. I'd pull out my phone and
that's
look.
All right.
Yeah, there's like probably another half dozen of those that I like, but
okay.
I'm not sure which one's standing out for me.
Right, obviously, we got work to do there.
Yeah, yeah.
To better branding.
Yeah.
When you talk about drones, you have been flying now, again, one of the first few people that I knew that were flying one on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. What excited you about the drone?
I don't know. I was first tuned into it or turned on to it in, I guess it was 2010. I got my first drone. It was the Parrot AR drone. It was $300. And I guess what maybe appealed to me was how stable it was, and I could fly it with my phone at the time, you know, and it was just an interesting technology I had not seen before. And I was like, oh, I'll try that, and took it up. I think I crashed it the first day. There were no parts available. You know, this is pre-GPS drones, and I definitely took it up higher than I should have, and the wind caught it, and I hit the emergency kill switch so it wouldn't fly away, and landed on the roof. And then it landed upside down, but it was – or wait, no. Landed right side up, but the edge of it was in the gutter. So I was like, well, I'll try it. And so I initially didn't break it, but it was the second attempt to fly it off the roof. It flipped, hit the concrete two stories down, and then broke. So it was out of commission for a while. But yeah, that was my first intro into it, and since then I've gotten into the DJI products, the Phantom and the Inspire, and love flying those, and gotten really into it. Yeah.
What's the coolest thing you've flown over?
It always makes me nervous, but the High Trestle Trail Bridge. It's a challenging place. The first time I rode my bike out there, and I have a backpack for my Phantom, so I threw my Phantom in that, and then I had intended to go out and catch the sunset, but this was, I think, middle of summer, fall, or what, and the mosquitoes were horrible. And so I'm out there and just got all bit up. But just being knowing that if it goes down and it's out over that, you're not getting it back. And there could be interference from the bridge. And but it's an exciting, it's just kind of a unique place in Iowa, and I enjoy enjoy that view. And so I've been out there a couple times to fly it. But
yeah, the High Trestle Trail is a bike trail that runs from Des Moines to keeps on going. But this specific spot is over a river, mm-hmm. and it's outside of Madrid, Iowa.
Correct.
Between Madrid and Boone.
Yeah.
Eventually, I guess it's actually
Woodward and...
Yeah, more closer to Woodward, I suppose. So, yeah. Central part of the state. All right, so that's cool. Other places that you like to fly over that are fun?
It seems like I tend to fly just here, just for the convenience. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll just fly over this area here. I don't know. Wherever I have the opportunity, it's frequently challenging to find good spots to fly. Because I kind of, when I go out, unless I'm doing it for, I am a certificated commercial pilot now, but unless I'm doing it for commercial use, I try to go to places where I'm not going to bother anybody and they're not going to bother me. While I fly in my backyard, I don't fly over my neighbor's houses. You know, I like to keep my neighbors happy. And
do your neighbors, what if your neighbors want pictures of their house?
They've asked for them, and I've done that for free for them. So, yeah. I haven't gotten any complaints, and they've, as far as I can tell, think what I'm doing is cool, but I haven't bothered them with it. So, usually to fly in my backyard, it's just to either maybe capture a sunset or to just test things out. But, I've literally driven for hours just to try to find spots out in the country or whatever. And I wish it was easier to find those places for fun to fly. But, yeah.
So you have helped a little bit with the Land and Sky project that Iowa Public Television is doing. Andrew Bott has been flying a lot. Did you pick up some points from him? Did he pick up points from you when he started to fly?
Well, I have not flown for that project.
Well, I'm sorry. But, when I say it's more but, like a consulting, and clearly you sure. probably had some conversations with
yeah,
him.
Yeah. I mean, I several years ago did a brown bag lunch presentation for the station. At the time, I was, I think, one of the only people flying here. And I was the first, even though I don't fly for the station, I was the first person at the station to get the FAA certification for commercial use. Which was very exciting. It's coming up for renewal here this year, and hopefully the government opens back up because that has been holding renewals up.
Okay.
I have some friends who are that do work in that field and can't renew their certification because government shut down. So, but I think Andrew, I've definitely gone back and forth with, and he's taught me stuff. I've taught him stuff. It's great to see that level of interest and knowledge. And, and it'd be fun to fly definitely for the station. I in a heartbeat, I think I would,
yeah.
would do that. The only thing I think I've done for the station is a shot out in front of the building shot.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was before all the rules were and laws were in place to get that. So
I've seen those the Terra Lake project that's right next to us here in Johnston, Iowa is one that I've seen many times from you.
And that's a convenient place. It's and that's a case where I don't have an official answer from the city. In fact, the city is liked things I've posted on Facebook or social media from that park, but there is a sign at the front of that park that says no model aircraft. But legally, you can take off and fly over that. But if you go by what the sign says, you couldn't take off and land or operate from the property based on that city regulation. So I usually am outside that park when I take off and land and operate, but it's definitely a nice big open place to fly that's not frequently super mm-hmm. occupied. So, I haven't had any complaints. I give people stop and ask some questions sometimes, but yeah, it's a pretty place to fly for sure. And it's been fun to document the evolution of that park, because I've been I would have been flying there since before they built the structures and or the shelters. So.
So if I wanted to find your work, if someone wanted to find it, how would they find it?
You could my personal website is dannysdigitaldomain.com, and you can from there you could probably find all my social links to social networks and
What's your favorite social media to use?
I would say it's Instagram now.
Really?
Yeah. I get zero engagement on Twitter. So, I mean, I don't engage people too much on Twitter either. So, but for personal use, yeah, I've really gone to Instagram. I used to be a huge Flickr person. I would upload my hundreds of photos from my vacations, and I don't have as much time anymore to do that. And
darn, you know, kids.
Yeah. So, love them, but I find that I'll just focus on maybe one or two. Instagram has a limit of 10 photos. So, but usually one or two photos and then cross post that to.
So to follow you on Instagram is how?
It's just Danny Engesser, DannyEngesser. You can find my Instagram there, and I try to post, every couple of days or once a week or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to market a little bit here. What have you found about the internet from that show and what's put on that might be different than what traditionally works somewhere else, but for us it works, or maybe it doesn't work?
It's been interesting to watch how when something is released, it's very specific to the date. I mean, the people that are interested in that content are interested in it that night, and because of the markets, and so you definitely see the spikes on that night for stats, and so that's. I don't know if it's unique to market, but it's definitely something that in my other social media things, I don't experience or need to experience, but it's something that market definitely has.
If we don't get it right on Friday night, it's problematic.
Yeah, it'll be too late, 24, 48 hours later probably.
Because there's been, it used to be, you tried to have stuff all posted on the website ready for viewing by 8 o'clock. Now we've got it back to almost 6 o'clock.
Yeah, between 6 and 7, we usually have it all up there, that night's show. And,
putting things onto YouTube. We used to host the video on our website locally, right? Or was a video service of some kind?
We were using... This was when kind of the early days of, I don't know if market had video, but we were using Real Player for a while for video and audio. And then we switched to when iPhones, iPods could start supporting video, we switched to a streaming format, that it appeared to be hosted on our site, but we were using a service called Limelight to host that.
Yes.
And, the technology was called HLS, Hypertext Live Streaming, even though it wasn't live. And basically what that technology allows you to do is step up or step down bit rates. And Netflix, you'll notice this with Netflix or Amazon Prime. It may look garbly, they call it macro blocking. And as it realizes your connection speed, it will gradually maybe increase that. And if you have a faster connection, you won't maybe even notice that. But it allows... for fluctuations in your bandwidth. And so we allowed three bit rates at the time, one for low and medium and high. And that's, that technology allowed us to do that, but with streaming through YouTube, it kind of eliminated, YouTube was being universally supported in the mobile devices and kind of eliminated our, it was challenging to post the HLS files because it was every 10 seconds there was a separate file.
Oh.
And a folder for each of those bit rates. And it was challenging to archive that and even watch that in as a archival media.
Yeah, well, you have taught me a ton about making sure we I told Brian Bauer when he was in here one time, I said, I label things on my desktop still mm-hmm. in the way you two had taught me how to do mm-hmm. with the year first, you know, 2018, 01, 15, underscore. And I'm like, why do we have to do this? And it totally makes sense now when I come to you and say, hey, remember this thing from 2015? Do you think? And you, and I said, I looked in the 2015. I mean, it makes total sense on yeah. how to do that. Where did that reasoning come from?
We first decided, is it something we need? We were doing it for our own use for the web team. It wasn't kind of a station archive necessarily, but it occasionally turned into that where someone will need something from there. But just keeping it simple, you know, we don't require any descriptive words in there unless you want to add something. But yeah, we just tried to keep it as short as possible. I don't remember why we exactly settled on that, and the, you know, the file name base is based on sorting and searching and yeah, we've been doing that for, well, I don't know, 8 years maybe in that format at least.
Yeah.
Probably longer than that, but.
Instead of just saying new, one, yeah. other, old, test.
And we definitely have those come through,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I know.
It's definitely challenging to keep up with that method, but it historically has been a successful way to find stuff and to archive stuff.
So Friday nights, the market producers will work to get, I guess I'll use a sports analogy. We get the baton to a certain point, and then you usually take us across the finish line. We've tried to reduce what it is that you have to do. You've taught us on how to do a bunch of things to reduce the work, and we understand workflows. It's mm-hmm. like a factory. I mean, mm-hmm. we're trying to understand what's best and what looks best, and you'll say, I don't think this is the proper A format, B resolution size, and you know we've come up with various debates over the years, and you've always been very helpful to mm-hmm. us to make that experience as best as possible
yeah.
for the consumer. You always have the consumer in mind.
I try. Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a balance, definitely, between our needs and the consumer's needs, and yeah, and just figuring out that workflow. There's a lot of people putting this together, and we, even on the web team, we alternate those Friday nights, and it's between me and two other people on the team, and that handoff can, because it could be different people every week. That handoff maybe looks different week to week, but ultimately we get to the final finish mm-hmm. line. So.
Well, and I know that I look back at, I don't know, it was a year ago or however long we started, I was tired of when I would look on the website for a certain, for the full show, because, you know, when we put video out for the Market Plus and the full show and something else, and I was like, these always look the same. Why can't we have, you know, so we came up with the three different images from the show to kind of say, oh, that's what that show was about. It was, you know, trying on that design front, and we had to work through the whole, all right, well, you gave me a horizontal photo, mm-hmm. but I need vertical for this small. So, again, your design, your background helped us get to the point where, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. In fact, I thought of it just last week when I was saving the image for the year in review of the combine, and I'm like, okay, no, I don't want the combine this way. Mm-hmm. I got to have the combine this way because the head will be a perfect third. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here trying to think of that, just how we shoot video in thirds.
Yeah.
We have to think of the same thing in thirds for design on the web.
Yeah, I mean, there was an image, I don't know, a week or two ago. I forget which day. I think it was a semi maybe being towed by a bulldozer or something.
Yeah.
The initial shot I received, it was a little too tight to work in that space, but I went into the video and I found a wider shot of it and seemed to work. I may have even extended the sky or the ground a little bit, but yeah, it's definitely a challenge to take, you know, a wide format image and make it a tall image weekly, but yeah.
And also, I have to give you props for this podcast, specifically for the logo design that we have and for the idea of what to call it. And we worked about search terms and what would look best in Google. And the image of the microphones in the room was, I believe, yours as well.
I think Joe did the design. Yeah, I did not do the logo. I think the week that we started the podcast, I realized we needed an image online. So I just came in here quick and took a photo with my iPhone and photoshopped in real quick the logo and still using that.
Yeah.
We're how many episodes in? 200?
This is 135, something like that. So a week, every week. So 130 weeks in a row.
I assumed it was going to be changed after that week. You know, I didn't know. But yeah, that was a quick photo that I did.
And it's amazing how something quick ends up being lasting, and it works. Because I'd have changed it if I didn't think it worked.
Yeah.
I think having the two different ones just kind of helps. It just looks a little different.
Yeah.
So we always thank you for helping get this thing launched. And, some people said, oh, well, you'll only be doing this for 3 weeks. And a couple of years later, we're still at it.
Yeah, it's a nice, fresh perspective on people involved with the show and people in the industry. Yeah.
And I like to have people know what goes on, mm-hmm. not just what they see on television or on their tablet.
Yeah.
It takes a whole team of people to make it happen.
Yeah, definitely.
So we thank you so much. And here, you were worried that you weren't going to have enough to fill.
Yeah, I was just trying to flash back to early days of the market website. I was like, I don't remember anything.
And you really didn't deal with, I always ask everybody a good Mark Pearson story. I mean, did you ever interact much with Mark? I mean,
not a ton. I guess another way I connected to the show is because I went to school for video broadcasting, I had the opportunity to run cameras several times for the show. And whether that was, I think in a couple of cases, I was running multiple cameras where there was a camera that moved. And so I'd run and do the moving camera and then I'd do the other camera. And but that was a fun diversion to something from my past and my education that I got to utilize in the real world. And so I occasionally would converse with Mark, but it was just a few times. But the thing that I remember was that he's such a different character off camera than on camera. He's very, straight on camera and he's just joking all the time once he's off camera. So I really appreciated seeing that side of him, I guess, too.
Yeah. And that's something you try to capture with stories like here, and that's what podcasts allow you to do, is to get behind and fully explain some things that maybe a photo or a video story just didn't accomplish.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right. Danny, I appreciate it. Thanks for sitting in here and having a conversation.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
What's your topic of interest for a podcast? Send us a note. market@iptv.org. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.